This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about recent developments in the case of Anwar al-Awlaki.
The question the case starkly poses is, can the United States target for assassination an American citizen outside a war zone? That may even include the United States.
We'll speak with filmmaker Kouros Ismaili about the new film on Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This extraordinary film, Justice on Trial, gives us a context. Corrupt police, the bent out-of-shape judicial system, presents new evidence of Mumia's innocence.
We'll speak with co-author Miriam Schneer about the new book, Final Verdict, What Really Happened in the Rosenberg Case.
This truly is the final verdict, and this book is the truth about what they did to the Rosenbergs.
Stay with us. We have a few updates for you today. The Department of Justice announced last week that CIA officials will not face any criminal charges for destroying dozens of videotapes showing torture of terrorism suspects. This decision comes after a nearly three-year investigation by a special federal prosecutor, and it's just one more instance in which the Justice Department refuses to seek criminal sanctions for the CIA's detention and interrogation program. The special prosecutor, John Durham, may still decide to charge both current and former CIA officers and attorneys with making false statements to a grand jury over the course of the investigation. Durham also has to finish the part of the investigation that looks into the death or abuse of detainees in the hands of CIA officers who used tactics that were unapproved by the Justice Department. It seems that one problem with the case was that those who actually destroyed the tapes said they got approval from CIA lawyers to do so. The former head of the CIA's clandestine service was Jose Rodriguez, Jr., and Robert Bennett, his attorney, calls him a hero and a patriot for what he did. We at Law and Disorder call him a lawbreaker, plain and simple. Along with so many others, he was able to conduct criminal actions with impunity, all in the name of national security. His memoir was released last Tuesday, and in it, George W. Bush strongly defends the use of waterboarding. The book is called Decision Points. Bush writes that when asked to approve waterboarding on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he immediately answered, quote, "Damn right." In the book, Bush staunchly defends the use of waterboarding as necessary to his efforts to prevent a repeat of the September 11, 2001 attacks. He writes that waterboarding was limited only to three detainees and resulted in what he calls intelligence breakthroughs that prevented future attacks. He says that preventing another attack was his most meaningful accomplishment while in office. Waterboarding, which is illegal under the Geneva Conventions, was banned by Bush's successor, President Barack Obama, shortly after taking office in 2009. Interrogators are now required to follow interrogation guidelines laid out in the U.S. Army Field Manual. During Bush's presidency, as listeners will remember, the U.S. came under international criticism for its treatment of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan, and foreign terrorism suspects held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Bush writes in his book that there were two techniques which he does not describe that he felt went too far even though they were legal, so-called legal, and he ordered that they not be used. But he did approve the use of waterboarding. And on a final note, last week I went to Philadelphia to go to the oral arguments before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I went with a group of Mumia supporters from New York, including members of the Committee to Save Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the committee has raised money for nearly two decades to pay for legal defense in his case. On Monday night, the film called The Barrel of a Gun was shown at the Constitution Center. This film really looks at what happened in the case from the eyes of law enforcement, and I believe it was funded in part by the Fraternal Order of Police. It was made by an individual named Tigra Hill, and he later, after the film, debated some of the points of the case with filmmaker Johanna Fernandez, who's a professor at Baruch. We've had Johanna on the show in the past, and she did what I think everyone in the House thought was a really cogent and compelling recitation of the specific facts in the case. At 2 p.m. sharp, the oral arguments began. Judith Ritter, who's been co-counsel in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal for 7 years and who had argued the Mills v. Maryland claim 3 years ago, listeners may remember that was the only claim that prevailed that day, argued again that jurors had been given an erroneous instruction when they were asked to vote on both mitigating and aggravating circumstances in reaching their decision of whether to impose death or a life sentence. So the argument was pretty technical, talking about whether the form led them to believe that, the actual wording of it, the checkboxes, the subcategories. And those of us in the courtroom really felt that not only did she do a thorough and meticulous and really compelling job in arguing, but we also thought that the prosecutor, Hugh Burns, was peppered with a lot of tough questions by the three-judge panel. And it's of note that this was the same three-judge panel that ruled 3 years ago that the Mills v. Maryland claim had, in fact, prevailed and led jurors to lean more toward imposing a sentence of death. So as Judith said to reporters after, the law is on our side. Listeners will remember that this case had gone to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court remanded or sent it back to the Third Circuit to revisit their decision on the Mills claim in light of a recent Supreme Court decision called Spezak, in which the High Court held that even though the jury form in that case might have misled jurors, it didn't ultimately affect the outcome of the case. But attorney and Professor Ritter argued that there are significant differences between Mumia's case and the Spezak case. So it may be a few months before we have a decision from the circuit, but we're hoping that they will follow precedent and uphold the Mills claim in this case.
Can the Obama administration or any future administration use lethal force against U.S. citizens who the executive unilaterally determines are a threat to the nation? The government claims it can and is apparently wanting to test this in the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen living in Yemen. The government claims it has unreviewable authority to carry out targeted killings of Americans deemed to be enemies of the state, even if they are outside a war zone. The ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a lawsuit on behalf of Anwar al-Awlaki on August 30th in Washington, D.C. In a recent interview, Pardis Kabriai, a CCR attorney, said, "While the administration has publicly declared global war powers to target and kill U.S. citizens and others wherever they may be, when it comes time to defend and explain its breathtaking claims in court, the administration dodges the issue and raises the specter of national security to persuade the court that it should not, indeed cannot, inquire further and to trust the executive." Today we're joined by Pardis to give us an update on this important case. Pardis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Pardis, I know the Center and the ACLU, and you're one of the attorneys, is representing al-Awlaki, the man in Yemen who the U.S. has targeted for assassination. And I wanted to get some background on what the U.S. position has been on this case and what's going to happen at the oral argument.
Okay. Well, what's going to happen at the oral argument is that this will be our first chance in front of our judge to, you know, make our case and defend our motion for a preliminary injunction and respond to the government's arguments. And the sum and substance of the government's arguments, though they've written about 60 pages worth of argument, is that there should be essentially no role for the court at all in addressing a question, the question we've presented, which is whether the government has the authority to execute one of its own citizens without any kind of due process. And that is the summary, you know, the sum of the government's position. They've made various arguments about standing, political question, state secrets, arguments that are familiar, and that courts in many cases have rejected before, but that's the basic substance of their position, is that there should be absolutely no judicial review at all. They have not gotten into the merits of defending why they believe they have this authority, but their position is that no court should be involved in reviewing their claims of authority.
And Pardis, they've also argued the armed conflict against al-Qaeda extends everywhere, correct?
That's right. The basic premise of their position, which they've just asserted, they haven't really explained, is that the United States is involved in a global war against al-Qaeda. This is a war that the Bush administration called a global war against terror, the Obama administration calls a global war against al-Qaeda, but that the United States, by virtue of this war, has the authority to target any suspect of al-Qaeda anywhere in the world who, you know, the United States deems to be a threat. What is different here is that, you know, while there are recognized conflicts, whatever one may think about the legality of the authorization for the use of force in Afghanistan or Iraq, there are objectively armed conflicts occurring in those countries. Outside of those zones of conflict, the question of whether armed conflict exists is a factual, objective question. It's not a matter of what the president declares. And the level of hostilities and the organization of the groups in Yemen are just not such that they rise to the level of war. And separately, the United States is alleging that this particular person, our plaintiff's son, Anwar al-Awlaki, is part of a group that is not al-Qaeda, but that is associated with al-Qaeda. So even if one were to accept the premise of a global war against al-Qaeda, this particular group is separate and distinct from al-Qaeda. So the U.S. is not only claiming broad global authority geographically, but global authority in terms of any and all groups whom the executive deems may be, you know, somehow linked to al-Qaeda. Sweeping authority.
Parties, do they assert their right to assassinate this American citizen based on the authorization for the use of military force that went all the way back to November of 2001, right after 9/11?
The authority, their claim, it's a little bit unclear. They claim both a basis under the authorization for the use of military force, which is obviously what authorized the U.S. to go into Afghanistan, but they're also claiming a very vague principle of self-defense, which is tricky because self-defense has to do with, and they're claiming this under the Article 51 of the U.N. Charter. Well, the right to self-defense under international law under the U.N. Charter has to do with the legality of the use of force vis-a-vis two states.
Yes.
So that might address the question of whether the U.S. has the right to violate Yemen's sovereignty and use military force within the territory of Yemen. It does not address the separate question of whether the killing of an individual within Yemen's territory is lawful. And the U.S. is really conflating those two questions to say that, you know, they have the authority both under the authorization for the use of military force, but also as a matter of self-defense to do what they're doing.
Yeah, well, that's what's so scary, that they are taking that authority and going around criminal law to execute somebody in Yemen.
Right. I mean, they're going around criminal law, they're going around international law, and claiming unreviewable authority to carry out global assassinations, which is really an escalation of what we saw under the Bush administration and what people found very alarming, which was global detention authority. Here we're talking about global killing authority, really. And whatever the allegations against this particular person, the point is that the authority could reach any U.S. citizen or any suspect that the United States deems to be a threat to, you know, its national security.
Could it reach someone in the United States?
Yeah, that was my question.
It could reach someone in the United States. The full contours of the government's argument would be that the decision to kill is for the executive to determine, and that should be an unreviewable decision, and that it's based on unknown criteria about involvement with terrorism or membership in al-Qaeda and associated groups. So there is no reason why it couldn't reach beyond Yemen to the United States or other countries.
Pardis, I have a technical question. We're talking about drone-based killing. Can you explain how that would work?
You know, the point about drones is, and it's not entirely clear whether the killing here would be carried out by drones, but I think the concern is that it just adds to the completely unaccountable nature of the killings here. And it sort of raises a moral issue as well. You have pilots who are manning drones based in the United States, sitting in secure rooms in the United States, using joysticks to essentially kill targets based in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Pakistan, wherever. And, you know, the costs of what's happening are really just not felt by the people conducting the killings or even by the American people. And I think that alone is sometimes a check on, you know, the conduct of war and how willing people are to escalate war. So it's sort of the mechanized, disconnected nature of the killing that I think is alarming, both from an accountability point of view and a moral point of view.
It's scary. They recruit these kids who are good at video games, and they set them up in an office in Nevada.
That's right. And the second point about the drones is that the drone program is operated by the CIA and by a covert unit of the Department of Defense called the Joint Special Operations Command. And again, these are covert programs, and that just goes again to the point about just lack of accountability. These killings occur. No one knows about when they happen, who they happen to. Documenting them is just incredibly hard, but yet you have an expansion of the war and of killings sort of in this shadow war way that's very separate from the way the war is occurring in Afghanistan, where you have troops on the ground, for example, and you know, a certain level of transparency. What's happening in terms of the expansion is really this parallel secret war being conducted by the CIA and by JSOC, largely through the use of unmanned drones.
Now, you do, I think, give an example of when they could actually use force against someone like El Awlaki in another country. Can you just outline that a bit for us?
Sure. I mean, it's important to say our position is not that the United States can't take any action against people that it deems are threats, and that action couldn't include the use of lethal force. But what we're saying is that the context in which this targeting is occurring is not a war context. It's not an armed conflict context. And the rules are the Constitution and the international law of peace. And under that framework, the government could only use lethal force in self-defense if there is an imminent threat of deadly harm, and lethal force is a last resort. And what seems clear here is by virtue of putting someone like El Awlaki or others on a kill list and predetermining the need and the authority to kill, that fact alone really cuts against this idea, this constitutional requirement of imminence and last resort. So we're saying that if El Awlaki or others present imminent threats of harm, and lethal force is a last resort after non-lethal measures have been pursued and are not available, then that individual could be killed. It's not that there are no scenarios where that could happen.
And by non-lethal, you mean an attempt to arrest the person.
Exactly. Arrest, detain, and you know, what we have here really is a predetermination, the ability to kill. That just is completely inconsistent with the idea that the need to kill can only be determined under the Constitution and under international human rights law at the moment of application. You can't determine that fact months in advance.
Pardis, this fits into the whole paradigm shift from law enforcement that responds when a crime has happened to preemptive law enforcement and targeting of individuals the government thinks may be a threat.
That's right. And the U.S.'s position about the ability, the authority to carry out preemptive strikes and preemptive killing is illegal under the law, but it's also completely rejected by most of the international community. You can only respond with the use of lethal military force when an attack has occurred. You can't sort of preemptively determine the need for, you know, the use of military force like the government is claiming here.
Now, have they indicted El Awlaki in the United States yet?
They haven't. As far as we know, he hasn't been charged by the United States. There have been reports recently that he might be charged, you know, in Yemen. That actually, if he were charged in Yemen, that would be even more support for the fact that the United States could and should charge him if there's credible evidence against him.
I'm assuming here, and let me see if I'm right on this guess, that they're not going to indict him in the United States, because if they indict him, it implicates really what you're saying is the proper way to go about this. Treat him as an alleged criminal, get enough evidence, indict him, and then try and arrest him. If they indict him, then they, I think, have much less claim that, well, this is a war against al-Qaeda. We can kill these people anywhere. We don't need to go through a constitutional process. I don't know whether there's enough evidence to indict him or not, but it seems to me almost that indicting him would cut against really what they're calling for, an incredible amount of executive power to kill even American citizens anywhere in the world.
That's right. That's right. I think this is very much tied to the government's claim that there is a war going on in Yemen, and that's a message that the administration has consistently been making and escalating since last year, actually, since the attempted attack on the airliner by Abdul Muttalib and the alleged connections to Yemen. There's just been a steady increase in the rhetoric about Yemen. It's an escalation of the language of war, and they really are, I think, using this to set the stage to declare that Yemen is, you know, a war zone. Clearly, that's what they're saying, that it's another kind of Afghanistan. And, you know, by declaring that, the rules completely change. It makes Yemen a battlefield where the laws of war would apply, not the Constitution, our human rights law, and the restraints on what the government could do are far broader. It's a terrifying proposition.
So oral argument is happening, and what's the next stage? We'll wait to see the judge's decision.
Well, where's the oral argument? I know we're speaking to one of the oral arguers.
The oral argument.
Who is now preparing for it. So tell us, where is it?
The argument is in Washington, D.C., in the district court before Judge John Bates, who's quite familiar with many of the arguments the government's making because, as everyone probably knows, the district courts in D.C. have been handling the Guantanamo litigation. He's probably well-versed in a lot of the political question arguments the government's making, a lot of the state secrets issues. So it'll be interesting to be before him.
Well, what was interesting to me is, of course, that he gave you 2 hours for the argument, right?
That's right.
Which is extraordinary, actually, which means he's taking it seriously, even whether you win or lose. It's pretty amazing.
I think he is. And if you look at his decisions about Guantanamo, and they're very reasoned, and I think he's very interested in these issues, and in particular the armed conflict issues. So, yeah, we have an hour on each side. And then it'll be a matter of either if he wants further briefing on certain issues, because the government essentially has not really addressed any of the issues on the merits, we might have another round of briefing. But if not, we would just then be in the position of waiting for his ruling.
Well, Pardis, good luck at the argument. And, of course, we're following this crucial case. And I'll tell a last story. I remember right after 9/11, after they passed the authorization to use military force that says you can use president of the authority to use force against any nation state, et cetera, that was involved in or harbored 9/11 people, conspirators, someone came up to me at a talk. I was giving a talk a week after that passed, which was by late September of 2001. They said, you know, Michael, this can authorize a killing in the United States. And I said, come on. I couldn't believe that. But this was a smart guy who was, at least according to what the government's doing now, that would be their claim.
Right. I think that is the full extent of their claim. And for the court to have no role in reviewing that authority at all, no role in reviewing the authority to kill a U.S. citizen in violation of the Constitution. It's an extraordinary position.
Pardis, I hear you have a nice quiet office in which to prepare.
New York for you.
I know.
I thought that was your cello. You know, Pardis was almost a professional cello player.
Really?
For 14 years,
life.
Right?
Wow. And,
this is her reincarnation as a...
After this case, I'm going to go back to the cello. Thank you.
Pardis, we'll be thinking of you.
Bye.
Talk
bye.
Soon.
So
bye-bye.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
We're pleased to have with us today the director Kouros Ismaili, producer of the new documentary Justice on Trial. The film focuses on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the most scrutinized and contested legal cases in American history. Justice on Trial examines the facts of the case, the judicial bias, the racial discrimination in jury selection, prosecutorial misconduct, and tampering with evidence to obtain a conviction. The injustices and problems in Mumia's case, as many listeners know, are common within the criminal justice system in the U.S. We are pleased to welcome filmmaker Kouros Ismaili. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's very good to be here.
This is a pivotal time in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and we understand that you have rushed, actually, to finish Justice on Trial in order to have it screened in Philadelphia with Tiger Hill's competing film. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, when we started working on this film a few years ago, I tried very hard to get interviews with the widow of the police officer who was killed on the night of December 9th. And I was looking all over to be able to interview her. I think it's important to sort of for the film to be able to show the impetus and the values of the other side of the story, to show what it is that drives that side. And I wanted to get that part of the story. And in doing that, I sort of realized, and I met Tiger Hill, in that process, realized that they already had their man. They already had someone who was making a film from their perspective. And in that process, I came to understand Tiger Hill is making a film that's sort of basically a propaganda for the other side.
And just so listeners know, Tiger Hill's film is called Barrel of the Gun. Your film that you produce with Johanna Fernandez
is called Justice on Trial.
That's right.
And in fact, your film does present, you have a lot of interviews with prosecutors, police. I think you did a very well-balanced job. Nevertheless, it is clear, and it comes through in your film, the fact that we have a very strong police union in Philly, the Fraternal Order of Police. Mm-hmm. We had a judge, Sabo, they called him the hanging judge, who had been a member or very friendly with the police unions, didn't recuse himself after serving as trial judge, and stayed on with the case. And a very tight community, as it were, in Philadelphia that seems rather pro-police. So I think that came out. Also, I wanted to congratulate you on the fact that the media, the day after both films were screened in September, really, I thought, did a good job of comparing the films, mm-hmm. and not just focusing on the pro-police aspect.
That's right. This was our strategy from the very beginning, that we want to make a film that speaks to a very wide audience. We want to talk about the case of Mumia in a way that can be talked about by people who don't know the case, even by people who might not be on Mumia's side 100%. And I think in order for us to do that, we had to sort of contextualize it and show what the controversy is about and how different sides of the controversy see this. And I think we were able to do that as much as we could get access to all sides. And I think that does speak for the film. And that, to me, is what makes a film be better than a film that's obviously a propaganda piece. And Tigray's film really just reiterates the arguments that the prosecution made within the trial and makes it seem like these are the facts, when we know that the prosecution, in Mumia's trial, actually resorted to misconduct. They resorted to suppressing of evidence. They resorted to asking for false testimony. All this our film brings out as fact, which is. I think for that reason, we're hoping that our film will be seen as a factual look at the case rather than a propagandistic look at the case.
One of the fascinating aspects of the film is that you present evidence of photographs taken literally 12 minutes after the shooting occurred in Philadelphia by photographer Pedro Polakoff. Can you tell us how you discovered those photographs?
Well, those photographs were not discovered by us. They were discovered by Michael Schiffman, who is an activist and a scholar in Germany, who was surfing the internet, and he came across a photograph that he recognized as being a photograph from the night of December 9th, 1981. And it was a photograph that Peter Polakoff had put as part of his website, general photography website. And Michael Schiffman came to the U.S. and went and met Polakoff and realized that Polakoff has about 22 photographs that he took from that night. It turns out that Polakoff had actually offered those photographs to the prosecution, had gone and said, I have these photographs from that night. You want it? The prosecution has said, no, we don't want it to go away, because they already had their own photographs, the official police photographs that they were using and manipulating in a way to make the crime be seen as if it was done by Mumia. They didn't want any other visual proof of that night. But Polakoff, who actually thought Mumia was guilty, he just put them away because they were of no use until they were discovered. What the photographs show is incredible. They show a roving police hat. Officer Faulkner's hat is placed in different spots on the crime scene minutes after the crime happened. So, they were moving objects around. They show the police handling the guns that were supposedly used in this crime, handling them without gloves. Upwards of half an hour, police officers were just sort of handling these guns that could never be used as proof. They also show that the prosecution's main witness that the prosecution used, who claimed to have parked his cab right behind the scene of the crime, right behind the police car, the photographs show that cab was never there. The prosecution's main witness was lying, basically. So the photographs show some basic discrepancies in the story that the prosecution laid out, that the jury heard, that led them to give Mumia a guilty and then a death penalty sentence.
Especially with everyone sensitized to crime scene investigations from TV and
Michael Connelly books.
Right. It is stunning to see one of the officers holding the gun, carrying it around with him in these photographs.
It's not a secure crime site.
Right. And it's not a secure crime site. What, for you, was the highlight of making this film, Kouros?
I think I'll speak as a filmmaker. For me, the highlight was realizing that there is such a thing as fact versus fiction. And when you make films, you get into sort of what is real, what is not. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier. I realized that the most important thing we can do that will help this case is to be able to show the facts and convince people that these are the facts. and not just sort of presume that, you know, you will believe these facts if you believe our side of the story. And I think sort of going through these facts and try to look at them from various angles, from various sides, and coming up with what is unarguably, I think, a series of arguments that we make in the film, that to me was sort of, it sort of transformed me as a filmmaker and as someone who knew about the case, but didn't know it as deeply as when I got into it.
Kouros, what kind of comments have you received thus far on the film?
People who know the case very well have received this film very well, and it's very important to see that people who know the case think that the film did justice to it. But I've had comments from people who don't know the case that well, and overwhelmingly what people are saying is like, thank you for not thinking that we're stupid. Thank you for giving us the facts and allowing us to make our own decisions. And I think as much as we can be able to do that as a movement and as a film, to just offer the fact that the facts speak for themselves, and we should not be afraid of what the facts say. And seeing people react to the basic facts and seeing the injustice out of the basics of what happened, I think has been the most rewarding for me.
Kouros, I'd like to just add one final thought that was mentioned in the film and that I thought was a powerful comment. That was, a couple of people have said, if the prosecution has such a clear-cut case that Mumia did this, then why are they so afraid of having a new trial?
Absolutely.
And I think that you did a really fair job of presenting both sides in this film that shows the passions on both sides. It was very moving, and you really should be commended for it.
Thank you. So there is a whole machinery, a political machinery in Philadelphia that's dedicated, whose career has been based on this conviction. The DA at the time of Mumia's trial became the mayor of Philadelphia and is now the governor of Pennsylvania. Another DA who fought against his appeal is now the Supreme Court, the chief Supreme Court justice of the state of Pennsylvania. The DA now, who's an African-American, came into office promising to carry out the execution of the political establishment in that city and that state is built its career on this, and reversing this indictment, reversing this case, or retrying it is going to expose a lot of corruption by a lot of people who've got a lot of power. And we need to understand that in order to sort of go forward with this case. This is not just a legal case. The legal aspect of it is absolutely important. We need a new fair trial, absolutely. But the way to get that is to fight against a big political establishment that's ingrained, that's very powerful, that's fighting every step of the way. And I think if we understand that, it will help us sort of figure out our strategy as a movement to bring any kind of a justice to this case.
I think that's key to the entire case. Kouros, we wish you the best of luck. We will be spreading the word and hoping that people can arrange small screenings of this film around the country.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in 1953 as spies accused of giving the secret of the atomic bomb to Russia was the high point of the spreading fear during the McCarthyite anti-communism period of the 50s. Walter and Miriam Schneer wrote the groundbreaking book Invitation to an Inquest in 1965, exposing the frame-up of the Rosenbergs. More information has come out. And now, in Walter Schneer's book, with a preface by Miriam Schneer, Final Verdict, What Really Happened in the Rosenberg Case, has just been published and tells us the full and whole story of the frame-up of the Rosenbergs. Miriam Schneer, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be with you.
Miriam, Final Verdict is just an extremely good book. And I think to help listeners who don't know that much about the what really happened in the Rosenberg case, could you tell us what they were accused of and what they really did?
Okay. I imagine some of your listeners know a lot about the case, but many don't, so I hope those who know will bear with me while I try to sort of set the scene a little bit. The case began in 1950, 60 years ago. World War II allied Soviet Union was now the Cold War enemy. McCarthy had launched his campaign against communists and the government. Alger Hiss had been convicted. The Hollywood Ten had been convicted. And most importantly, the Soviet Union had recently exploded its first atomic device. And it seemed in the United States, first of all, the United States atomic monopoly was ended. And it looked as though American cities were vulnerable to attacks such as annihilated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So in that climate, the Rosenbergs were arrested. It was July 1950. Julius Rosenberg was arrested. Less than a month later, Ethel Rosenberg was arrested. Both of them, they were charged with stealing defense and secrets and transmitting them to the Soviet Union. Now, I should say that the official charge, the legal charge, was conspiracy to commit espionage. But during the trial itself, Rosenbergs were accused of having stolen the secret of the atomic bomb. The lead prosecutor, Irving Seipel, said that this was the weapon, and I'm going to quote him here, that might well hold the key to the survival of this nation and means the peace of the world. In other words, the stakes were very, very high. Although, you know, the judge and the prosecutor, and one of the other prosecutors, incidentally, was Roy Cohn, both prosecutors and judge called the Rosenbergs traitors and said they had committed traitorous acts, although, of course, the trial evidence in no way reached the high bar of treason as it's defined in the Constitution.
So that's the charge, is conspiracy to commit espionage. How did the trial go? And I guess focusing on the two key things that happened at the trial, that final verdict now really destroys is actually happening, which I guess are the meeting and what happened at the meeting in New Mexico and what happened in the claimed meeting in New York. But
right. But
first tell us what came out at the trial and then now what really happened as a result of
okay. Of
your and Walter's research.
The principal witnesses against the Rosenbergs at the trial, and I should say Sobel also, but I'm going to focus on the Rosenbergs here. The principal witnesses were Ethel Rosenberg's brother, David Greenglass, and David Greenglass's wife, Ruth Greenglass. David confessed, and his case was severed from the trial. David had been a GI during World War II. And he was young, in his 20s, and he was from New York City, as were all the defendants. He was sent by the Army, completely serendipitously, to Los Alamos, New Mexico, where the bomb was being constructed. Research was going on toward developing the bomb. And David, being a communist, made up his mind to agree to pass information. Now, he presented himself as kind of a pawn of the Rosenberg. He was Ethel's younger brother, you know, was kind of a weak person, and he presented himself as someone who just sort of went along with it and spoke about Julius as being sort of the mastermind of the whole thing and that he turned over information based on his own work at Los Alamos to his brother-in-law during furloughs to New York. And on one occasion, he passed the information to a Soviet courier named Harry Gold from Philadelphia, but he worked for the Soviets, and that occurred in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Miriam, so they were accused of stealing the secret to the atomic bomb, but what
Correct.
In fact did they really do?
Well, what Julius really did was give information on military industrial information during the war on his own work as an engineer. And he also recruited quite a number of his former classmates and friends and comrades in the Communist Party, who also were engineers, to give the Soviets, through him, their work. So he was a spy during the wartime years. Ethel did nothing. She was not a spy. And that's, I think, been conclusively proved. She knew about what her husband was doing, but she herself did not participate.
So let me take you back to both the trial and the incident that's now really exposed as a fraud in your book, in Walter's book, and then your introductions. Out in New Mexico, Gold, who is the courier, a Soviet courier, comes and meets with David Greenglass. And according to the trial testimony, as I recall, Greenglass said at the trial that that the evidence was, Gold said, "I come from Julius," meaning supposedly Julius Rosenberg.
And he also refers to him as his brother-in-law, Julius.
As his brother. And he comes with a half a Jell-O carton in which he says that, "I was given this Jell-O carton, tore it in half," and I think Ethel Rosenberg, if I'm right, tore that in half, "gave it to me, and that's my sign of recognition with you, David Greenglass." So you have a Soviet courier basically implicating Julius right in the middle of the actual scene when David Greenglass, the brother of Ethel, turns over this so-called sketch of some part of the bomb. That's the trial. Now, what was Walter and your work able to disprove about that in this book that you lay out?
This incident in Albuquerque, New Mexico, when Harry Gold arrived in the doorstep of the apartment of David and Ruth Greenglass and said the words, according to his trial testimony and according to the Greenglass trial testimony, "I come from Julius," and showed the Greenglasses half of this Jell-O box side, and then the Greenglasses produced the matching half, and that was their material password recognition device. Well, what we were able to find, and these are findings that piled up over many years, was first that originally Harry Gold told his attorneys way back in 1950 that he had used a password. He told that he had come to Albuquerque and seen a GI there and had received information from the GI. However, he said when he was asked what the password was, he said it was "I come from Benny" or something like that. He didn't mention any torn or cut piece of card at that point. David Greenglass did mention a torn or cut piece of card. So you had two people mentioning different devices, and they were then brought together 10 days before the trial by the prosecution and allowed to discuss all this and apparently make their testimony complimentary. And they had this very well-constructed story of what had happened there. What Walter and I discovered, or I should say what Walter discovered in his later research, was that the card had actually been cut by Ruth Greenglass in her own apartment, presumably. And we don't really know how half of the card got from Ruth to a Soviet agent who then passed it to Harry Gold. But it was Ruth who cut the card and who set up who asked for the meeting with the agent.
So the evidence at this point is fabricated with regard to Ethel and the card, as well as the "I come from Julius" is utterly fabricated.
That's right. That's right.
In your research, what did you find out about the level of government and prosecutorial involvement in this?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because what we discovered is that, and again, this is information that became available over many years, part of it as a result of the suit brought by the Rosenberg sons, Michael and Robert Mirapol, pursuant to the strengthening of the Freedom of Information Act after Watergate. And they received hundreds and thousands of pages of government files, and particularly FBI files. Then later on, in 1995, by the release of the so-called Venona documents, which were KGB cables that went between New York and Moscow, and which were intercepted and translated and decrypted by the predecessor agency to the NSA. Those cables also discuss the some of the events of the case. And then most recently, actually after Walter's death in 2009, there was a release of finally the documents known as the Vasiliev notebooks. And these were KGB files that Alexander Vasiliev was allowed to see and take notes from, and those original notes have been released, and they're available online now. And what all this shows was that the U.S. government knew many things about the case that they held secretly and that they didn't share with the prosecution. For instance, they knew that the pretrial statements and the grand jury testimony, all of it under oath, of principal government witnesses, especially the Greenglasses and Harry Gold, conflicted with the story that they told the jury at the trial. The defense had no knowledge of this and no way of knowing it. They also knew that the importance of the material that Greenglass, who after all was a high school graduate and machinist, the importance of the material that he gave to the Russians was grossly exaggerated. The Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy issued a report where they ranked Greenglass as the least effective of all of the atomic spies that were known. And General Groves, who was head of the bomb project in the 1940s at Los Alamos, he told a closed hearing of the AEC that the data that went out in the Rosenberg case was of minor value, although he added, of course, they deserved to hang. So we see that there was, you know, just a lot of effort on the part of the Department of Justice to convict these people. They also knew perfectly well that the evidence against Ethel Rosenberg was very weak. In fact, one of the prosecutors said, the evidence against Ethel is weak, but we can want to arrest her and use her as a lever to try to force Julius to confess and to name names, name names being the byword of the Justice Department in those years.
Miriam Schneer, who wrote the preface and the afterword to her late husband Walter Schneer's excellent book, just came out, called Final Verdict, What Really Happened in the Rosenberg Case. And this truly is the final verdict, I think, for all of us who have wondered over the years about the Rosenbergs being framed up and what exactly they did and didn't do. This book, it really explains what happened. I think there are a lot of lessons to be drawn today with the Islamophobia and the fear in the air in this country, thinking about what happened 60 years ago with the Rosenbergs. The Rosenbergs were Jewish, and the undercurrent of anti-Semitism was there, just like the undercurrent of anti-Muslim fear is here today. And I wanted your reflections on that.
Well, all of the defendants, plus key prosecution witnesses, plus the judge, plus two of the prosecutors, say Paul and Roy Cohn, were all Jewish. It was like a pogrom. Interestingly, there was not a single Jewish member on the jury, and this was a trial taking place in downtown New York City, so it was quite an unusual situation. But the case is, I agree with you, Michael, that the case has tremendous relevance to the present and is worth really thinking about today in a larger framework, I think. We can see that the Rosenberg case is like the Dreyfus case or the Sacco-Vanzetti case or the Scottsboro Boys. It's a part of the history of American radicalism. And to me, it seems essential that leftists of each generation should keep that history alive because it's part of the identity of the group. When the Rosenbergs were arrested, there was widespread fear of a foreign ideology. Then it was communism, and as you say, with a sort of silent background of anti-Semitism. Now, Islamic fundamentalism. Now, that's not to say that there was no danger. There was danger then. There is danger now. But at a certain point, you see fear increasing to the stage where it's no longer possible to think rationally. So in both periods, you see the government use the courts to advance policies, for one thing, in the Rosenberg case, of course, we see them using the justice system to exploit and to ratchet up fears. In the 1950s, it was fear of atomic annihilation. So such silly responses as stuck and cover exercises where school kids were told to crouch under their desks. Fallout shelters were being erected and dug out in suburban backyards and stuff like that. But we also had more serious repercussions, and one of them was to keep a post-World War II military budget growing and skyrocketing, really. And today we see the fear of the foreign enemy being used to justify the preparations for what apparently is going to be an endless war, an endless state of war. Then there's domestic surveillance. Maybe I should just mention that on a personal level, Walter and I learned from the Freedom of Information documents that we received on the basis of the Mirapol suit that while we were researching Invitation to an Inquest, the FBI had tracked our activities. They used, and I think this is interesting just because we were just, you know, we were young. We were just two writers who were trying to research a book, and they were tapping our phones and mail, using mail covers and visiting contacts and calling Walter's place of work. And finally, they placed us, along with thousands of others, on an index of people who were going to be detained in the event of a national emergency.
You were in good company. I was on that list.
You were on that list, too. Yeah, I know. A lot of good people were on that list, actually. But, you know, we didn't want to leave our kids who were like 3 years old at the time or something. And then after the book was published, an FBI memo, an actual memo, directed that the book should be smothered and forced out of the public eye.
Amazing.
And fortunately, that was one goal they didn't accomplish.
Well, you write about J. Edgar Hoover's role in framing up the Rosenbergs, and you can understand why they'd want to suppress that book and why they, if they could, why would want to suppress your current book, Final Verdict, What Really Happened in the Rosenberg Case by Walter Schneer, with a preface and an afterword by Miriam Schneer.
Miriam, you took us through one of the incidents that happened, which is the incident in New Mexico where green glass, you know, obviously was fabricating about who gave him...
Green glass gave data to gold.
Right, about gold and where the name I Came From Julius came from, as well as the Jell-O carton. And that, of course, you know, obviously implicated David much more than Julius and Ethel once the true story is out. And the other incident was in the apartment, so-called incident in the apartment here in New York, which I think was September 45, when supposedly green glass gave the sketch to Julius and Ethel supposedly typed the notes. And apparently, according to Final Verdict, as I read it, that never happened. Julius was already had been dismissed as a spy by the Soviet Union, so they wouldn't have let him operate like that. And it appears that the sketch was given much later from the revealed Soviet files. Now, that's what it talks about in Final Verdict. And if you can just, do I have it right?
You have it exactly right. And, you know, the firing of Julius is probably the most dramatic of the proofs. What happened was that Julius, in February of 1945, was fired from a government job as a security risk, probably as a result of a black bag job break-in to a Communist Party headquarters where the FBI got hold of a list of party members. In any event, he was fired, and the Russians responded by becoming worried that the security risk was not the whole story and that the government also had wind of his spying activities. And they decided to terminate him, to actually fire him as a spy, to sever his contacts with all his other agents, including the green glasses. So here we have this atomic spy, supposedly, during the climactic year of the atomic bomb, the year in which the first bomb was exploded in the deserts of New Mexico, and where the passage of information on the bomb by David Greenglass was supposedly taking place through Julius Rosenberg, and Julius Rosenberg was fired. He was inactivated by the Russians. Now, as far as the episode in the Rosenberg apartment, that really is the key of the case. It was at that particular family get-together where David Greenglass testified that he gave a sketch to Julius Rosenberg, and Roy Cohn asked him at the trial, was that the atom bomb itself? And Greenglass said, yes.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And we've been the final verdict reprints the sketches. The reader can judge for themselves, but as I think it was Philip Morrison, the scientist, who said that they were caricature of the bomb. It was not the bomb, and beside it had a lot of errors in it. Well, in any event, and the story went that Ethel Rosenberg had then typed up David's explanatory material. Well, what Walter discovered, and no one else had noticed this before, up until this point, was that, first of all, David Greenglass, in September 1945, when he was on furlough in New York, met directly with a Russian agent out on the street and had a conversation with him. And that, secondly, they set up at that time a December 1945 meeting. And we don't really know if that meeting ever took place or not, but what Walter discovered was that several weeks after that meeting, there was a receipt in Moscow of information from David Greenglass. So it becomes quite likely, and I would say, to me, it seems overwhelmingly likely, but the reader has to judge for him or herself, that the actual transmission of the so-called sketch of the atomic bomb itself and the related explanatory material never took place in the Rosenberg apartment in September, but actually took place at some unknown place in December.
Well, Miriam Schneer, we have to wind up now, but I want to encourage all of our listeners to go out and get Final Verdict, What Really Happened in the Rosenberg Case, written by your husband, your late husband, Walter, with a preface and an afterword by yourself. This is one of the great human dramas of the 20th century. With a brother testifying against a sister, with Jews being used against Jews. Your book, Final Verdict, is the final verdict on what happened here. This book is really required reading. So we thank you very much, Miriam, for your hard work, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Miriam, thank you. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. It's been great talking to you.
Right. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.